It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. Tim Stevens, Jason Snell join us. We'll talk about the FCC's net neutrality proposals, what they really mean. Google and Apple bury the hatchet in a very surprising move. And this just in, YouTube about to buy Twitch for $1 billion. It's all next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 458, recorded May 18th, 2014. Choose the guy with the helmet. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Lynda.com. Learn what you want when you want with access to over 2,500 high-quality online courses, all for one low monthly price. To try it free for 7 days, visit lynda.com/twit2. That's lynda.com/twit and the number 2. And by Shutterstock.com. With over 35 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 20% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use the offer code TWIT514. And by Citrix GoToMeeting with HD Faces, the powerfully simple way to meet with coworkers and clients anywhere. Share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing. Even present from an iPad. Start your 30-day free trial of Citrix GoToMeeting today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code TWIT. And by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get 2 free books. Go to audible.com/twit2. And don't forget to follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show that covers the week's tech news. A great team of professional technology journalists in the studio today to discuss the tech news. Actually, one in studio, the fabulous Jason Snell, executive.
I'm a team of one today in the studio.
Team of just one, but that's okay. Jason is, executive director, executive editor?
Sure, editorial director.
Editorial director. Yep. I knew there was a director in there.
Yeah. At IDG. Shout action every now and then. That's
cut! Cut! Yeah, of course, for a long time, editor-in-chief at Macworld. Are you still editor-in-chief at Macworld, or do you have to
sort
give that
of
up?
Technically, there is no editor-in-chief at Macworld right now, so I guess technically it's me, yeah. But Dan Miller does a lot of the work for me.
But you also now cover Windows, which is nice, PC World.
Right, so I'm in charge of PC World and Greenbot, which is our Android site, and TechHive, which is covering a whole bunch of different
tech
consumer
Hive. That is my new destination. I know you developed that. We talked about that about a year ago, I think.
Yeah, it's been a little while.
You should play Flappy Golf.
Oh, you should play Flappy Golf.
No. That's Tim Stevens over there. Tim's with CNET. He covers motorsports, drives his own little, I guess the ice racing's over for the season.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say it's a little bit too warm for that. It'd be lake racing at this point, and that's no good in a Super Bowl.
Not good. Well, thank you for breaking away from the coverage of the trials for the Indianapolis 500 and joining us this afternoon. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
The biggest story which just broke, and I don't think it's too much of a surprise. We've heard rumors about it all weekend. Not Apple buying Beats. I don't know what happened to that. That one just disappeared.
It's out there.
Blub, blub, blub. But
buffering?
Buffering, yes.
Please wait.
Buffering. But the real story is $48.5 billion AT&T buys DirecTV, the satellite TV provider. They've been kind of partners for a long time. That was part of the triple play package before UVerse came along. Why did AT&T buy DirecTV? Anybody?
All the cool kids are doing it.
Hey, everybody's got somebody.
Well, I mean, AT&T, so they've got their... They're in a weird broadband place, right? They've got their fiber in some places.
Mostly DSL, right?
But it's mostly DSL. They don't have a lot of TV except in those a few UVerse markets.
Is UVerse fiber always, or can it be DSL as well?
Well, they've kind of rebranded. I got an email the other week saying that UVerse was available to me for the first time, and I checked because the fiber is like right on the other side of the freeway from my house, so it's a mile away, but it's not at my house. So I got all excited. I was like, all right, fiber in my neighborhood. Mm. And I looked, and it was rebranded DSL, that they just decided to call UVerse, but was not actually fiber. So
pretty much guaranteeing that you'll be unhappy with everything.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I used to have that. I had the AT&T DSL. Ugh. And I switched to Comcast only because I needed it to be faster. Not that I love Comcast. Anyway, I mean, DirecTV does give them access to a whole huge customer base, and they, you know, they're a TV provider. They're not a very good broadband provider because of the latency and satellite, but it gives them another piece of the puzzle, which, you know, I think all of this mass media consolidation is really puzzling to me. I'm not sure quite what all the financial ins and outs are.
It feels like you have to have critical mass in some way. Does DirecTV still do the Hughes internet satellite stuff? So they still do,
they do
internet.
Right. Yeah, and if you're like,
just upgrade that not too long ago. They're up to a couple megabits down anyway. There's still the latency. They can't get that down much under a second. I think it's around 800 milliseconds. I did test not too long ago, and it is much improved than it used to be, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. But still, that, you know, there's only so much you can do with latency, and maybe this partnership with AT&T will give them some more communications options for the upload side of things and to get the latency down. But yeah, I see this as a content play. You know, this gives AT&T a lot of good content partnerships for, you know, streaming video, video on demand, that kind of thing.
And NFL, yeah, more than anything, because DirecTV has the NFL Sunday Ticket deal. And that is very lucrative. 17 weeks a year, that is a very valuable property.
I don't want to poo-poo the satellite internet too much. Those of us who live in big cities are used to having faster internet, or even in suburban areas. But I grew up out in the country in Sonora and Northern California, and most of the people I went to high school with who are still there, they're all on satellite broadband because it is faster than any other option. So it's, you know, they're just adding more pieces to the puzzle. And the DirecTV deal with the NFL, is assuming that continues long term, maybe there's a way they can parlay that into something they can roll out to other subscribers, although Verizon has the deal for mobile streaming for the NFL. So it runs
up against
that.
That's why I think it's interesting. Yeah. I think that's why it's an interesting, probably an anti-Verizon move. Well, Tim is up in the country. So, but you don't use satellite.
I actually tried to use satellite when I first moved to this place about 2 years ago, and there was no cable access when I moved here. So we did try the new Hughes system, which was pretty good, but I just couldn't get over the latency. That wasn't good enough, especially for this kind of thing. You know, there'd be a 2 second delay pretty much.
Yeah, it's unusable
kind of Skype thing
for Skype. Yeah.
So when I switched over to Verizon, has an LTE to the home service that I was using for a little while. That was pretty good, except as you may remember, we had a couple of instances where it kind of dropped out on us, and that wasn't very much fun. So now I do have cable here. We paid Time Warner to bring it out to the house. But yeah, satellite internet has definitely gotten much better in terms of the outright speed, but I don't think there's really much they can do, at least through satellite technology, when it comes to getting that latency down, which is a big issue for online gaming and anything that you need any kind of responsiveness. But if you're talking about streaming, you know, streaming Netflix, that kind of thing, it was actually perfectly fine for that. I was able to get 1080p streaming through Netflix with no issue over satellite, and I think that's pretty impressive.
You do have, you know, fair use caps, and that's a bit of a problem. I can't remember what it was, but last time it was pretty, I checked, it was pretty low. It was in the hundreds of megabytes.
30, not even that. I think they're a maximum of about 50 gigabytes, which for me on cable before I moved here, I was about 500 gigabytes a month. So that was obviously a bit of an adjustment to be made to try and make that work. And that was the same thing on Verizon too. It was about, I think, between 30 and 50 gigabytes was the maximum. And then it was something like $10 per gigabyte once you went over that. And that gets very expensive very quickly.
So you just heard the thing that makes this whole net neutrality debate very interesting. You, Jason Snell, were on DSL but switched to cable because it was faster.
Right.
Tim Stevens out in the country paid Time Warner to bring him cable because it was faster.
Not that I love Time Warner, but I wrote them out a very large.
Nobody, and you hate Comcast, you hate Time Warner. I've got Comcast, the same thing.
Nobody likes their cable
cable company. And in most cases, they're really the only viable choice. Yes, you may, and you know, this is where that net neutrality debate comes up, is yes, you may have other choices. If you're lucky, you have DSL choices. You might have in satellite choices. Almost everybody has that. But nobody really wants that. Everybody wants cable, so which gives these cable companies immense power, and that's why we're very nervous about these access lanes. So this was the week, Thursday, finally, we saw the rules that Tom Wheeler and the FCC have been talking about for several weeks. We've been talking about for several weeks. They were, as predicted, and by the way, they're not implemented. This is merely they voted 3-2. It was a close vote to offer these rules up and give people a chance to comment. Highly recommend that you watch this week's This Week in Law, Denise Howell, and a very heated debate. Nilay Patel talking with a regular on This Week in Law, whose name is, I've forgotten. Say again?
Barron is his first name.
Barron Zorich or something like that. But it was almost fist fight. I mean, it was very heated, as one would expect. Nilay Patel of Vox and The Verge was very concerned about the future of net neutrality. The question is, and this was the one thing that might have been changed in the rules thanks to all of the conversation over the last couple of weeks. Tom Wheeler did propose, and the FCC did adopt the proposal, that perhaps they should look at reclassifying broadband providers as common carriers, so-called Title II of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. This is something that a lot of geeks have said is a good idea. The genesis of this is that the open internet rules originally proposed by the FCC were thrown out in court. Verizon sued. The court said, look, we understand there is a strong, compelling argument for open internet, but you don't have the jurisdiction as the FCC under the Telecommunications Act, Section 706, which is what the FCC was using as a justification for controlling the internet, isn't it. The court said you could go the Title II route. FCC has up to now, I think, kind of rejected that as a possibility, but this is the first time they've actually raised it and said, in effect, to us, what do you think? Should we go Title II? And that was the big debate on This Week in Law, was whether Title II was a good idea. It would certainly bring a lot of regulation in. And God knows, nobody wants government regulation on the internet. But at the same time...
Nobody wants monopolies controlling the internet
that's
either.
That's the real problem.
And I think it would be fair to say nobody really wants the internet to be in a position in the U.S. where it is a common carrier issue, where there's no choice. But that's where we are, is there's in most markets, there's no choice, no legitimate choice for broadband internet. And I don't consider the AT&T DSL that runs to my house legitimate competition for Comcast. And in a situation like that, that's when you have to kind of pull out the common carrier rules, which are pretty serious because that's a lot of regulation. And it's kind of scary to go down that path. But I don't know what other choice we have left in an environment where almost nobody has decent competition for broadband.
That's the real problem. I mean, you could talk about the open market, the value of the open market, but if you don't have competition, there isn't an open market. Maybe the FCC should act to encourage competition. One of the things that Title II would allow it to do, for instance, is tell the cable companies you need to open up your network for access to other internet service providers, just as DSL is open.
Right. I didn't actually have AT&T DSL at the end. I had DSL Extreme, which is a reseller. So there's
but they
a wholesale
ride on
price.
AT&T's copper.
Right. So they buy internet from AT&T basically wholesale and then resell it with. So instead of getting with your ISP, you get a web host and email and access to this and access to that. The idea would be those would be the differentiating features. The bare internet would just be something that everybody could resell with their own stuff on top of it.
In this case,
have competition.
One of the wonderful features that would differentiate is, and by the way, we don't charge for access to our subscribers.
Right.
You have a fast lane access to everybody on the internet. But we tried to get, by the way, and Dane wasn't able to make it, but we were going to get Dane Jasper, who is the founder and CEO of SonicNet, which is one of the foremost internet service providers in the country, and a very outspoken advocate of open internet, and would love access. They're trying to compete
as much as they can. They're doing a lot of double DSL too, which held the line for a while against cable, where you essentially
we have that product.
You
have
bonded DSL, and it's still not as fast as cable, but it's faster.
It's in our basement.
They want to compete. And competition is good. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of it. So either they need to do something to allow competition, or we're going to be in common carrier land, I would hope, because those are the only real options. Otherwise, our internet is going to be pretty poor.
I like Mike Elgin's article in Computer World this week. He said, FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler is the Michelangelo of lobbyists, and his proposal for net neutrality is his Sistine Chapel. He calls him the lobbyist in charge, and that's really what's happened. I mean, this guy worked for more than a decade at the National Cable Telecommunications Association, eventually becoming its president. He worked in the wireless industry as well. He's in the Hall of Fame of both the wireless and the cable industry for his tireless efforts on behalf of those industries. So it's hard to believe that he would himself lobby for regulating these industries. And AT&T filed a brief this week saying that, for instance, Title II was a terrible idea, would make it impossible for internet service providers to do their job. And this is where I don't want to get too much into this battle. I think Barron and Eli's debate on TWIL is a very good example of how people who share our interest in open internet disagree over what the right path is. And I know when we had John Perry Barlow on, one of the founders of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, he said the debates on the board, even at the EFF, at the board level, are intense because, you know, there's a strong prejudice against government regulation of the internet, but at the same time, it's not clear what the path is to keep the internet open. And we all agree we need an open internet.
And I have a concern what Title II would mean for Google Fiber as they're trying to spread it and give more access to that. And I mean, that almost certainly would slow down that effort, whereas we want, you know, Google Fiber to spread throughout the U.S. very quickly. More regulation would slow them down, and it may even stop that effort altogether, which would be very, very disappointing and very frustrating, because that is part of what is starting to build some competition in those limited markets where it's available. And, you know, competition is good in general, and it helps to build innovation and helps these services to get better. But like I said, Jason, there really is no effective competition in most of these markets. And that right now, it just means that these guys are able to charge what they want to, not innovate at all, and consumers are kind of left stuck.
I almost want to burn the house down. I think sometimes what happens with activists is they say, great, let's screw the internet up, because that'll force us to find an alternative. One of the real good alternatives is never going to happen unless things go vastly wrong, which is for community municipal internets to spring up, for communities to take over those broadband lines using eminent domain, saying we're going to run these as a utility. This is like gas and electric and water, and we're going to provide that. Let companies come in and ride on top of it and offer you choice, create competition in their communities, eliminate this whole thing. And I feel like, if we just let Tom Wheeler screw the internet up, maybe we have a chance at that.
Unfortunately, you know, most of these small governments just don't have – this
they
is a highly technical
yeah. –
well, it's so technical.
Yeah.
And do they have the budgets to even try it?
Yeah.
And, you know, I have friends who live in Alameda here in the Bay Area, and they used to have their own cable and internet company. And I think they handed it all back to Comcast because – you know, a little city under financial strain trying to manage their own, you know, be their own ISP and run cable to people's houses it's asking a lot. I mean, that's the hard thing is that infrastructure is hard and it's expensive. And you want people, you know, companies investing in the infrastructure to be able to get a return, but you also want to have competition. And, you know, a lot of these issues become less, you know, the great panacea here is net neutrality, right? Net neutrality, it's like, well, you can charge me and you can have stupid services that you're trying to foist upon me, but at least you can't mess up my internet. The internet is the internet. And that's the thing that's frustrating about all this net neutrality talk is that when the internet isn't the internet anymore, it's playing favorites and cutting backroom deals and making certain sites faster and certain sites slower. And that's, you know, when it gets all messed up.
Yeah.
And it's so obviously happening now. I mean, it's so blatantly apparent that Netflix is being capped on many, many service providers. And that right there is you know, as ugly an omen as you need for what's going to come in the future. If something doesn't change, and yeah, unfortunately, it's so ugly to find out exactly what that change needs to be. It's so difficult to find out. As you said, there are so many conflicts and so many challenges. But yeah, something obviously needs to change. We're at a point now where maybe legislation is the only thing that's going to keep things somewhat clean. But yeah, it's the choice of the lesser of two evils. And I honestly don't know which is the lesser at this point myself.
Well, it's frustrating for me because I feel like there's so much innovation that happens on the internet, and companies like mine wouldn't exist if I didn't have free and easy access to every one of the people who want to listen. If I were
Absolutely.
Put on a slow lane, you know, we wouldn't be able to offer you live broadcasts because you wouldn't be able to watch them in any reasonable way. Here's from Tech Dirt, a graph the cable industry proffered, say, you know, implying that they were increasing their investments in infrastructure. This is, well, it turns out a little bit of a misleading graph. You know, it says in 1996, they invested $5 billion. In 2013, $210 billion. But what this graph doesn't tell you, this is cumulative investment. So the $210 billion is over those 20 years. And in fact, if you look at actual investment, well, the tale is not quite so encouraging. After doing big build-outs, spending upwards of $20 billion in 2000 and 2001, some significant drop in investment over the last few years.
I'm curious if the investment the last few years includes the money they paid Verizon to stop building out Fios to decrease competition.
That's interesting. So wait a minute. I want to hear, because I know Verizon was building out Fios at great cost, about $5,000 a subscriber. And then they decided to stop. Why did they stop?
Well, apparently there was a deal that they cut with the cable companies to just back off and not do it. Yeah. I think we call that collusion, I
Unbelievable.
Think.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. No, it was just good business, I'm sure.
Well, and, you know, you can't expect these companies not to act in their own interest. That's what they're publicly held companies. They have a fiduciary responsibility to stakeholders to squeeze their customers as dry as they possibly can. That's why we have to, you know, take our own future into our own hands and do something about it. We can't expect them. And it's foolish to expect them to do anything but act in their own interest.
It is a funny conversation that we're having now where we're all really getting up in arms about asking for free market competition. I mean, this is not like we're asking for some crazy, like, internet communism where the people own the internet and there's nothing, you know, nobody can profit from it. We're just saying, hey, can we have the big companies fight each other over us instead of just cutting deals and each having their own little monopolies in their own markets? That's what's hurting customers.
All we want is a free market.
Yeah.
Is that too much to ask?
I want Verizon and Comcast to fight it out for my business. That's what I want.
That's all. Instead of having these local monopolies, which they all have. Well, I'm glad, actually, Tim, you got cable finally in there because you really look much better. At least for the time being.
Thank you.
So that's the other problem is all these companies
are... I'm hitting the gym too, you know, Leo.
Yeah, well, that too. Yeah, that too. You do look like you've been working out. All of these companies are in the same business as the companies that they're provide. You know, Skype competes directly with the VoIP offerings of Comcast and Verizon and Time Warner. You know, if Netflix competes directly with the cable offerings of Comcast. So that's the worst thing, is that these companies can act anti-competitively. Now, Tom Wheeler says, I'm not going to let that happen. And I trust him. I really do. All right, we're going to continue on in just a little bit. Good panel here. Jason Snell, Tim Stevens. Glad you're here. And a great studio audience. Thank you all for joining us. It's nice to have a
handsome
big audience.
Group.
Handsome group. Last week, they were all wearing shorts. It was a little too much. I couldn't take it. Fortunately, we got long pants, right? All right. No, I'm just kidding. Wear shorts if you want. Strip down if you feel more comfortable. Our show today brought to you by Lynda.com. I love Lynda Wyman. You know Lynda Wyman, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, I've known her for years. She was a regular on the Screensavers.
She used to write for us at Macworld.
Yeah, that's right.
All the time, yeah.
Wrote these great books on web design and development. She created a company, Lynda.com, that teaches people how to use software, how to program, how to become better photographers, how to use Photoshop better. Lynda.com is a great resource for anybody who wants to learn. And now they have over 2,400 courses in pretty much every category. 510 courses on web design, 414 courses on photography, 534 courses on business, things like creating a resume, negotiating a deal, and tens of thousands of video tutorials. The way it works is great, too, because you get unlimited access for a low monthly fee. You can have any course you want. You can jump right in at the beginning, or because they have transcripts of every course, you can search for the subject matter or the tip that you're interested in and go right there. There's new courses all the time. They just released a course on, this is a good one, how to prepare and print 3D models using Photoshop, how to master the fundamentals of photography. Some of my best friends, Burt Monroy, Ben Long, teaching courses at Lynda.com. You can learn about web design and development, everything from WordPress to jQuery. Do you use Windows? They've got a Windows 8.1 course, Windows 8.1 Update 1 course. They've got Microsoft, Creative Cloud, Final Cut, Logic Pro. Lynda.com, currently 2,577 courses. More are added every single week for every level, beginner, intermediate, advanced. And these are high quality, well-produced videos with the top professionals in their field who are passionate about teaching. Whether you have 15 minutes or 15 hours, each course is structured so you can learn at the pace and the style you want. Lynda.com also offers certificates of completion. So when you finish a course, you can add it to your LinkedIn profile. People know, hey, this person really knows Final Cut or Premiere or Photoshop. Not only is $25 a month for access to the entire Lynda.com course library, for $37.50 a month, you get the premium plan that includes all the exercise files so you could follow along with the instructors. But right now, for 7 days, if you go to lynda.com/twit2, you can access the entire library, lynda.com/twit2. the entire library free for your use for 7 days. How much can you learn in a week? Take the lynda.com challenge. Lynda, lynda.com/twit2. We thank them for their support of this week in tech. Let's see here. Should we talk about Google? Actually, some good news. I mentioned this, I think, this week on Mac Break Weekly after the Apple-Samsung trial finally ground to a close. Samsung won a little more than $100 million. Apple won a little more than $100 million. Samsung won a little more than $100,000. The awards are getting smaller, but the cost of the companies is getting greater with discovery. These documents, secret documents, having, you know, have to be released to the public. And I just feel like this is a war that nobody wins. It's bad for PR. It's bad for the companies. And I think maybe they're starting to realize that because Apple and Google have decided to throw in the towel. Apple and Motorola were suing each other for patents. They decided not only to drop those suits, but not to license, just to say, okay, use it. You think I'm right? Do you think that Apple is finally realizing that these lawsuits, win or lose, are bad for business?
Well, first I want to say that it's not bad for everybody. My sister-in-law actually works at the law firm that Samsung is using.
That's the
They're
winner.
Doing fine. They're doing fine.
Yeah.
It's bad. It's good for them. But I think, a lot of the criticism, I wrote a thing about it, a bunch of people did, about that book, Haunted Empire, which says how Apple lost its way. Yeah. One of the questions was, it was inconsistent on whether the point was that it lost its way because it was trying to do what Steve Jobs wanted to do, or that it was trying to be, like, different from the Steve Jobs game plan.
You know,
but I'm excited about the idea that in some cases Tim Cook is sort of unwinding some of the things.
That's what I feel like is going on.
Because Steve Jobs did a lot of things that were great. He did a lot of things that were like questionable.
He was vindictive.
I think going nuclear on the patent thing was probably a mistake, and he just couldn't help himself. And I feel like this is a sign of
personal
of Tim Cook kind of saying, "Let's back off. This is crazy. Let's go un-nuclear."
That's my take exactly. You know, the book that actually is most germane to this is Dogfight, which is how Apple and Google fought for years over this, and it talks about that. And really, that's kind of the thing. One of the takeaways from Dogfight is, A, that Apple knew that it didn't invent slide to unlock. This was an anti-competitive move as much as a global nuclear war.
Sure,
against
we think
Google.
This is cool, and we can stop you from using something cool.
Precisely.
So your product won't be as good.
Whether it's right or not, we think we can stop you and win this case. So I think this is the right thing. I agree with you. I think maybe Tim Cook's saying, we honored Steve's memory, but I think it's time maybe to move
on. All of the secret stuff comes out in court and these documents. We see Apple's behind-the-scenes stuff. I mean, I don't see how this helps Apple. And even when Apple wins the case, right, it's a couple hundred million, which for Apple, honestly, they've got that in their couch cushions.
Well, even when they won $1 billion. But now it seems like the awards are diminishing. Yeah. You agree, Tim?
Yeah, I definitely agree, especially in a case like this where we had kind of a split verdict, basically, where they both won it. And obviously, Apple won a lot more than Samsung did. But I think at this point, the consumers didn't really see that. They just saw that both companies won something. So therefore, both companies were more or less as right or as wrong. And so therefore, there was no clear victory in the public's eye. And they both lost because, you know, here they are both dragging themselves through the mud and dragging each other through the mud. And I don't think anybody really cares anymore. I don't think anybody's really that excited about the case anymore. And I think the fact of it is really that it kind of shows that Apple is really, you know, feeling somewhat trying to think of a good way to say this. Basically, they're still kind of bitter about how things went a long time ago, you know, with the origins of the smartphone, the launch of the iPhone, and what happened 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago. And really, nobody cares about that anymore. The industry has moved forward, and so therefore, these lawsuits, I think, are a bit of an anachronism at this point. I think that it's good that they're going to be dulling them down. I hope they do.
Here will be the real test, because Mike, you remember a few years ago, the Nortel patents were sold,
yeah.
And Google bid on them but lost to a consortium of companies including Apple, Microsoft, Research in Motion, the BlackBerry folks, Sony and Ericsson. It's called Rockstar, and they have 4,000 patents, which they've weaponized, basically.
Right.
And now this will be the test. This is the proof's in the pudding. And the problem is, it's not just Apple. It's Microsoft, it's RIM, it's Sony, it's Ericsson. But if these guys put down their weapons and stop going out, because Rockstar really was created to sue to get license fees for everything, yeah, including LTE, 3G.
That's come up out of this. You know, there's this whole industry of people buying up patents and building up these war chests just in case something bad happens. And, you know, if the main protagonists in these legal battles start to back off and start to put down their weapons, does that mean this industry goes out of business? And if it does, are they going to go quietly into the night, or are they going to, you know, lob their last Hail Mary charge and try to sue everybody and keep this fight going on? I'm curious to see how that pans out, too.
Yeah, Google, I have to think Google is the chief target of Rockstar. In the statement that Apple and Google released over the Apple Motorola lawsuits, there is this sentence: Apple and Google have also agreed to work together in some areas of patent reform. Maybe this means that they're going to kind of recognize that these patent lawsuits are good for nobody. They just slow down innovation. They're only good for your sister.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. It's a light at the end of the tunnel, and we're all hoping it is the end of the tunnel
and not
that onrushing train with a nuclear warhead strapped to it that we've been watching approach.
Hey, speaking of which, whatever happened, I really thought we were going to be running this tape from last week's show, in which I said I thought I was going to be eating my hat. I said that the Apple Beats thing was a bogus rumor and was never going to happen.
You want us to play the tapes?
Play the tape. It was a rumor created by Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine in an attempt to sell headphones and stock or whatever, and to gin up some interest in a company that is actually failing.
Failing.
That's what I thought.
Now you've gone out. You actually took a good...
Way too far?
Yeah, way too far.
Well, I don't think anything happened.
Please wait. Still buffering, still loading.
Is it dead or is it... See, I think it was a bogus... I feel like it was a bogus rumor. Maybe they're negotiating something. Maybe they want to put Beats headphones in the next iPhone. But I don't think that Apple wanted to buy Beats for $3.2 billion. That makes absolutely no sense. I think it was a bogus. You're looking.
I don't know. I mean, I can see reasons why they would do it, and they've got the money for it. I don't think it's unreasonable.
I think the entire tech journalism industry got sucked into this ridiculous rumor and just said, huh? And then they just bought into it. Hook, line, and sinker. Tim, you think... I'm right, or is, you know, I could be wrong tomorrow. They could make the announcement tomorrow.
I think the truth lies somewhere in between. I do think that probably the acquisition is likely, but I was
really?
Very, very nauseous at the way that the tech industry or the tech journalism industry in general reported on it. I mean, it was pretty much, it's confirmed, even though it's just basically, it was far from confirmed. You know, I don't think we'll hear anything about it until WWDC, if we hear about it at all. But I mean, I think it's probably happening. The question is, why is it happening? And that's you know, a broader question with some perhaps unsavory implications there. You know, it depends on whether they're trying to buy a culture or they're trying to buy technology. You know, if it's a technology, great. If they're trying to buy, if it's more of a cultural attitude change that they're trying to acquire here, that's a little bit more of a concerning acquisition. But you know, it remains to be seen exactly what the intent is here. And if indeed we will see, you know, Beats earbuds in the next gen iPhone, who knows?
Peter Kafka at Recode says, oh, it turns out it might not happen until next week. I think
I've seen a couple.
Record, you know, day 53, Beats held hostage. I think it's never going to consummate. I can't believe this was even considered this as a real story.
I wonder if that tweet actually affected the deal somehow. I mean, presumably,
Dr. Dre's video that he says I'm the first rap billionaire, hip-hop billionaire, that he pulled down immediately.
I hope he hasn't started buying stuff.
He did. He bought Tom Brady's house for $40 million.
Come on, Dr. Dre. Hold it together.
It's in L.A. It has a moat around it. We were thinking of building a moat around the Brickhouse Studios. I think it'd be good.
I mean, if you can have a moat, why not?
Lower the portcullis. Sir Jason Snell is here.
The city of Petaluma might have some issues. I love it.
Boiling oil on the roof in case... Revision 3 assaults us. Google Glass, worth $152, according to IHS. That's the materials list.
Yeah.
$1,500 if you've got the money to buy them. Now you can. You're running out to buy glass?
No, I think it's funny that first they did that one-day sale. It's like, anybody can buy it if you want, just for this day. And then they're like, actually, just we still have some. So you can just...
Google.com/glass. You can become an explorer.
Yeah, it's still the developer edition. I think that's the issue here is there will probably be a consumer-ish version. I mean, skepticism about Glass aside, I'm not sure any regular person should buy the developer edition of Glass.
It doesn't seem like a good idea. Let's see. I can choose some sunglasses. I could choose my color. I'm going to get tangerine. I can't add it to the cart. What's going on? I have to. Oh, it's already in my cart. Apparently, I've already gone through this process.
It's already on the way to your home.
Already? Oh, damn. Let's see. I first have to agree to the terms of sale. Click buy with Google. See, it didn't even ask who I am.
It knows.
It knows. I'm apparently buying two of them now. Again, I'm starting to feel like an old man, but this is another dumb idea. Who wants glass? Anybody wearing glass here? Any of you glass explorers in our audience?
No. I was.
No. You were? What happened to your glass? I was.
That was. It's complicated, but that was part of the Engadget thing. So now it's, I think, sitting in a closet somewhere at AOL.
They kept the glass.
Yeah.
I got the condo, man. Though,
so that's something, right? And the dogs.
You got the dogs? Okay.
Too. Yep. It's a great product. And if you got a lot of disposable income and you wanted to feel something really futuristic, glass is pretty cool. But yeah, I just don't see it as a consumer product yet. And I think that'll change in the not too distant future. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a lot of cool stuff at I.O. Here at the end of June. But the version that we're seeing now, yeah, like you guys just mentioned, that's a developer edition. It's not really ready for prime time. They're still pretty fragile. The battery life still isn't great. There's still not a ton of functionality. But again, if you've got $1,500 burning a hole in your product and you want to really feel something that's significantly different from any other piece of technology that you've bought in a long time,
it's cool.
You can blow your money in worse ways, I suppose. Get
punched in the nose in San Francisco, but it's cool.
Yeah, that too.
All right, word coming from Variety of a big acquisition in the tech industry. Don't show that! I was going to tease people.
Spoilers!
No spoilers! When we come back... We'll talk about it. This is TWiT with Jason Snell, Tim Stevens. I'm Leo Laporte. Our show today brought to you by Shutterstock.com. Shutterstock, I love going to Shutterstock and seeing what the count is of the number of images, royalty-free images on Shutterstock. It goes up all the time. The total now, 37,129,198 royalty-free stock images. This week, they added more than 250,000 alone. And these are high-quality photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, most of them shot by professional photographers, created by professional artists, each of them reviewed for content and quality. And, you know, when you have that many images, it's important that you have a good search engine. And Shutterstock has the best I've ever used. Search for nouns, like babies, but then you can search for adjectives, like dogs. Okay. I said babies.
You said nouns, and I was going for the nouns.
Babies, but dogs is fine.
Say happy
now,
dog.
Wait a minute, now search for sleeping or happy. Jeez. All right, we're at it.
Good baby dog.
Chad and I are out of sync.
A little bit, tiny bit.
Happy. These are all happy dogs. Can you find sad dogs?
Why would you want to do that?
Well, maybe you're writing a blog post about an unhappy
dog. Sometimes dogs are sad. Bassets are very sad. Lots of bassets.
Oh, my God. Those are the saddest dogs I've ever seen.
There's a dog
with a bindle. He's running away from home. Oh, my God.
A heart pillow.
There's a little doggy with a heart. All right. See, this is beautiful. So if you've got an idea, we have a sad dog because I accidentally told the groomer to shave Ozzy. And he doesn't. He's an unhappy Ozzy, I got to tell you. So if you are a blogger, if you're a journalist, if you need images, this is a great place to go. By the way, you can create an account. You don't have to give them a credit card. Do all the searches you want. You can even store searched results in the light box. Share them with colleagues and clients or just keep the images around for inspiration. You don't have to pay till you buy. And you can buy individual image packs. But I have, and I like, the monthly subscription. We have the 25 images a day. That's the standard subscription. Great for a publication. You can download any image in any size and pay one price. Great search tools, Lightboxes. Oh, I know what I didn't mention. They have great apps, too. An award-winning, Webby award-winning iPad app, now on Android as well. And those apps are just beautiful images that you can just browse and look at, and I love that too. Another way, if you're on a sales call, you can show client some ideas for images. Multilingual customer support in more than a dozen countries. Full-time customer service throughout the week. Shutterstock, I got to tell you, it's the best. Try it right now. Sign up for that free account. You don't need a credit card. But if you decide to buy, do me a favor. Use the offer code TWIT514. And new accounts will get 20% off on any package. That's why the subscription is such a deal. 20% off. But you have to use the offer code TWIT514 since we're in May 2014. That's TWIT.
Oh,
that's a happy dog. They have video with Alpha channels.
Man, it like teleported.
Yeah.
What the heck was that?
Yeah. Video. So that's kind of fun because we can use that in our green screen. You just do that right from the site, right, Chad?
I went to their footage area, and they have a lot of green screen, pre-made great green screen
Isn't
footage.
Great? There's a little puppy on our desk.
And you can make them grow.
Whoa!
Ah, giant dog.
Oh,
my
gosh.
Giant dog.
Tim, come back, Tim!
That was scary. Right.
For those of you listening at home, you're not missing
the video.
Anything.
And then we can make him disappear.
Amazing. Shutterstock.com. Use the offer code TWIT514. So this just coming across the wire. This is hot news. YouTube, according to Variety, set to buy Twitch for $1 billion.
The going rate for anything.
It's $1 billion for anything now.
Dr. Evil has set this rate.
All smaller forms of currency.
That's a good deal, actually. Twitch TV, which is created by Justin TV, is the network, I watch it all the time, that has video game play, and they have some real stars on there who are doing a great job. In fact, that's the number one category on YouTube itself, right? PewDiePie and people like that.
You know, it's funny. I've come to the realization. And sorry, I'm interjecting
that's
here.
Chad Johnson, who is a YouTube expert because he's under 25.
Right. I've come to the realization that YouTube might be the best place. The only content that really survives on YouTube might be gaming. And that's why iJustine and everyone has a gaming channel.
Oh, that's interesting. Everybody's moving to gaming.
And the reason is because it's so monetizable. Because you can do... the only real way to make a good salary on YouTube is to not only do, you can't make a good salary off of one video a week. The best way to do it is 3 videos a day because
oh my God.
No matter what video you put out, you're going to get a certain amount of views. So if you do 1 video a week, you'll get 100,000 views. But if you do 7 videos a week, you'll also get 100,000 views on those 7 videos. But now that's 100,000 times 7. And that's the only way to get the ad revenue to a point where you can actually make money. And
yeah.
The only content
that's how it is in life. If you work really hard.
But the only content that you can really pump out that fast is video game content.
It's crap.
Is my opinion.
Video game content.
Well, there's people who do it great, and there's people who are very entertaining.
It's trash content, though. It's very. I think you're right. I think that's
the
future of YouTube. Twitch.tv was clearly YouTube's biggest competitor of in any space, right? I mean, there was no question about that.
It's wired into Xbox and PlayStation.
It's so great on the Xbox. In fact, Xbox launched Titanfall on a Twitch channel. It makes a lot of sense.
I know what my kids are doing this summer. I'm just going to have them make Minecraft videos the whole summer.
That's the way to make some money. Forget a job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised, frankly, if Microsoft was in the bidding for this. In fact, this might have been a miss on their part.
A pretty big miss, yeah. I mean, that's definitely a big opportunity with next-generation consoles, of streaming video right from the system. And, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if Microsoft was definitely in the game.
Or Sony, right? Mm-hmm. That seems like they should. You know, according to this story, YouTube is preparing for U.S. regulators to challenge the deal. YouTube is number one for internet video, but Twitch is right up there. And I think that it's probably the case that if you have both of them, there's not much competition. The startup, going for $1 billion, raised $35 million in funding. So a big payday for their venture capital partners. Let's see, in March of this year, Twitch represented 1.35% of all downstream bandwidth, tripling since last fall. So, big growth curve. Again, this is from Variety. not confirmed yet by other sources, but Todd Spangler's pretty well connected, I believe it.
No, it's
has
a big
Dr.
deal.
Dre tweeted about it yet?
Not yet.
It's a big deal. My kids, I'm
Justin
not...
Kahn, I am the first internet billionaire. No.
My kids don't watch TV. They watch Minecraft videos on YouTube.
Yeah.
That's what they
yeah,
do.
Absolutely.
That's their programming of choice. They've ripped through the entire Twit YouTube Minecraft show archive.
They
oh
watch
my
Chad?
God. They
All
watch
right.
Chad, absolutely. They know who Chad is.
Right on, Chad.
But they can't stop. There are only so many of those videos, and there are thousands more videos to watch. And
how old are they?
12 and 9.
Yeah, Michael's 11, and that's all he watches is video game videos day in, day out, all
yep.
the time. He rarely watches TV. I can't think of him watching TV at all.
Yeah, so we watch.
I'm trying to get him to watch Cosmos.
We watch Gilligan's Island and stuff like that to waste away hours as children. Well, it's Minecraft videos now. That's what it is. And other video game videos when they get a little older.
Which is worse, actually. Wow. Well, okay. There you go. I think that's a good move on YouTube's part.
Yeah.
And I think they caught Microsoft asleep at the switch again on that one. Let's see. A lot of acquisitions. This is acquisition week.
And what's up with the Sunday night stuff? I mean, we have a
why are they doing this on Sundays?
Off.
Yeah.
No, it's got to be Sundays. We've got to be writing up acquisition stories, too.
Yeah, it's crazy. Google acquired WordLens. They did this during the week. Thank you, Google. This was a very cool app that was really kind of had a lot of profile on the iPhone. They did have an Android version. But I remember when it came out on the iPhone, it lets you hold up the camera, point it at a foreign language sign.
Totally works.
And it translated. It was the coolest
thing
ever.
It's like science fiction. It's amazing.
And it had been featured, actually, in Apple's ads. Well, I guess you won't see it in any more Apple ads because Google has purchased Quest Visual, the company behind WordLens. They say they're going to fold it into Google Translate, which Google Translate is a great product.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is a killer product.
Google Glass, too, is a natural fit.
It's and, in fact, I think Translate is it built in it? WordLens should be in there, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It was featured in Apple's latest iPhone ad. Also listed on the ads microsite.
And I know this stuff can get overhyped, but WordLens, for me, it met the hype that you hold your phone up, your camera to a sign. I did this in Montreal with French signs. I did this in Barcelona with Spanish and Catalan signs.
It's amazing.
And it tries to match the font. And
I know. It looks like the same sign,
except
suddenly in
translated
English.
Into English, yeah.
Wild. It's one. I understand why Apple put it in the ads. It's one of the things you show people when you say,
cool.
"See, this is where technology is heading." It is like the Babel fish that you stick in your ear. And Google Translate, you know, actually speaks. So when we were in Italy, for instance, you could say something to it, say, you know, "Can you ask where the museum is?" And it will say, "Dove è il museo?" or whatever, "il museo."
Doesn't do the hand gestures though. When it's
no, hands. You have to do those yourself. We watched before we went to Italy. We watched YouTube videos on Italian hand gestures. To make sure we did the right ones.
Right, right.
You don't want to do the wrong ones. Eric Schmidt's in trouble with the governor. I guess I did this last week. Didn't I do this last week? The governor's office in New York. Apparently, Eric is executive chairman of Google, is on a commission appointed by the governor of New York City to offer thoughts on the use of technology in schools. And I guess the consumer watchdog group, Consumer Watchdog, feels like he might just say, "Get Chromebooks." That's it. That's the end of it. I think if you can get somebody of Eric Schmidt's stature on your commission, you should take him. And presumably, he would have enough class to acknowledge that there's other choices besides Chromebooks. Norway says iCloud is illegal.
Well, somebody had to say it.
It's about time. Broken, yes. Illegal, well, Norway's Consumer Council says that Apple's iCloud EULA is convoluted and unclear. Like it's worse than anybody else's? The iCloud agreement is particularly bad, says the Consumer Council. More than 8,600 words. It's also unreasonable and unilateral. In its terms, Apple, for instance, reserves the right to change the agreement without notice. That's in violation of the Marketing Act. Finn Meerstad, the head of digital services at the Consumer Council, said cloud storage services rely on users' trust and confidence. The terms of iCloud undermine this. I think they'd have the same problems with a lot of these terms. The EU has also ruled that Google is going to have to enforce something called the right to be forgotten. In a kind of stunning misunderstanding of how technology works, the EU says that Google, if somebody doesn't like something that the Google search shows up, they have the right to go to Google and get it taken down. The European violation, I guess, of European privacy laws. But it seems like Google is saying, hey, look, we're an index of what's on the internet. You're going to have to go to the site that published this information to take it down. The European Union says, well, you don't have to take it down on the site. Just take it out of the search index. Nobody will find it anyway.
Right. I mean, this is, I mean, it's the laws are different in the U.S. than in Europe. But this, I find this really offensive because I've gotten notes from people who we've written things about embarrassing things they said or did in the past. And they're like, hey, I want you to, the good ones are, wow, I was a kid. That was 5 years ago. It's, I'm really embarrassed. Can you take that down? And I usually will obscure their name or something just to be nice. But there are other people who are like, their lawyer sends a note saying you need to take this down, which is totally not something we actually need to do. And that's what troubles me about this is that somebody who's using reputation.com or something like that is going to want to get some bad review or something about a legal case disappeared from the internet. And it might still be on my server and my reporting on it is completely legitimate, but they've gone to the search engines and gotten my URL blocked because they feel bad about it, which doesn't seem like an acceptable. It doesn't work, right? I mean, like you said, this is not how the internet works.
It's not how it works. The case came about because a guy in Spain wanted Google's reference to a legal notice that appeared in a Barcelona newspaper about his home's repossession and auction in 1998 eliminated. Not that the repossession and auction didn't happen, but they've been resolved for a number of years and it's entirely irrelevant. So he asked that the notices be removed from Google's index as well as from the newspaper's website. Google responded with a list of things that people have asked Google to remove.
Gallbladder, appendix.
Yeah. An individual who tried to kill his family asked that a link to the news article about the event be removed. An actor who wants articles about an affair he had with a teenager removed. A convicted cyber stalker mentioned in an article about cyber stalking laws requested that links to that article be removed. A physician requested that links to a review site about him that were apparently not very complimentary be reviewed.
Put it down the memory hole, right? It's 1984.
Hey! A former politician requested links to a news article about his misbehavior when he was previously in office be removed because he wants to run again.
These facts are very troubling and they get in the way of what...
And there are other implications, too. I mean, there's a DJ in the UK named Tiger Tim Stevens. And if you Google Tim Stevens, you'll find some stuff about me and some stuff about him. You know, could I file a request to Google to take down the stuff about him just so that my results show up in a better position in the search results? How would Google know, you know, which results to block and which not? I think that's an interesting implication here that... that I don't know if that was considered by the court or not.
Apparently, Google's going to comply. They say this is logistically complicated, not least because of the many languages involved and the need for review of each request. As soon as we thought through exactly how this will work, which may take several weeks, we'll let our users know. Apparently, the thought is they'll implement some sort of automated system.
So is the internet going to become like Snapchat in Europe? Is that just the internet expires after 10 years. That's just sorry.
Well, maybe that's a good idea. Just anything that's that old, just remove it. I don't know. The problem is that these people aren't asking for stuff to be removed that's false.
Yeah.
Or malicious or libelous. They just don't like it.
Yeah, it's bad savory.
I get the impulse, and a lot of it is innocent, right? A lot of it is I did something stupid 10 years ago, and I don't want it to stick with me forever.
That's reasonable for you to honor that request.
Right, right. But to go to Google and have them make it just disappear while the content still exists on the internet, potentially, that's bizarre. And also I worry about this being misused, right? Where people are hiding legitimate things that people should probably know because it's bad for them. It's bad for their reputation, even though it's true.
Yeah.
You
hit the nail on the head. It's 1984.
It's not like there aren't teenagers today who are going to regret things they put on the internet.
Well, that's the thing. I have some sympathy for that.
Yeah,
I mean,
totally.
I have there's stuff online about me I wish I could have taken down.
Oh, my God. There are posts on RecArt Star Trek, don't look them up, that I wrote in college that are, I disavow all knowledge of those reviews of Star Trek The Next Generation. I had nothing to do with them.
Really bad series of fiction stories I wrote for an Atari magazine.
There you go.
Every time I mention it, somebody dredges it up and pastes a link in the chat room.
Google. I'm gonna go do that right now, actually.
Stop it. Google.
I have a right to be forgotten.
Right for my bad writing to be forgotten.
Yeah. No, there's serious issues here where people have been involved in things maybe as minors or a long time ago. I totally get that, but it just seems so bizarre that this would be like this. We have laughter. You're calling up the Star Trek post now?
What? What? Somebody in the chat room put the link in?
Probably.
Great. Thanks.
Yeah. Anyway, you know, it's weird that the government is the one that's telling
us to
forget
this. Somebody in
the
chat room said, could you elaborate on more of the things you'd like to have removed? Let's have a better list.
Yep. Hey, I just did a little searching on the terms of service story, the last one. The word count on the Google Drive terms of service is 2,000. So the iCloud one is about 5 times larger. So that is a pretty legitimate complaint.
Who is going to read an 8,000 word terms of service?
Or even 2,000 for that matter.
You can have it mailed to you. I love that. That's the new thing Apple does. Would you like to read this or would you want to have us mail it to you? Oh, yeah. I'll read that in my leisure time later. It'd be some light reading.
You know, the ugly truth about a lot of those terms of service documents is that nobody reads them. And in fact, the lawyers often will take terms of service from some comparable site and just copy paste it and do a search and replace. And so you end up with some, if you really carefully read them, some of the weirdest contradictory nonsensical stuff because the lawyers don't even want to work on them.
So Roscoe has now posted that stupid article. Thank you, Roscoe.
Yep, that's it. Atari Magazine.
I want the right to be forgotten. Our show today, don't forget this, brought to you by our friends at Citrix and the great go-to meeting. Not all meetings can be planned in advance. Things come up, last-minute opportunities, work emergencies, great ideas to discuss. But nowadays, everybody in the office is spread out. People are on the go. You've got offices in many cases all over the world. It's impossible to get everyone in the same room. But with GoToMeeting, you can get everyone in the meeting instantly. It's a powerfully easy and simple way to meet and collaborate online whenever you need to, wherever you are. You can even video conference with GoToMeeting over an iPad. You can present from an iPad. They've got iPad, iPhone, and Android apps. With their face-to-face webcam sharing, that's really great. They've got beautiful HD webcams. You can have them kind of as a frame around the document you're all looking at, the presentation or the spreadsheet or the... I mean, it's just really great. It saves you time and money and lets you work smarter. Because you pay one low flat rate for a month of use, as many calls as you want, as many meetings as you want, for as long as you want. I know people who use GoToMeeting just keep it on all day long. Try it free for the next 30 days. Just visit GoToMeeting.com. Click the Try It Free button and use the promo code TWIT. We use GoToMeeting all the time here and love it. And I want you to try it free for 30 days. Just make sure you use the offer code TWIT. By the way, your attendees do not have to sign up for GoToMeeting. They can be on Macs, PCs, iPads, iPhones, Android. They don't have to sign up.
I hurt my back and was laying flat when I was supposed to be in a meeting, and I just opened it on my iPad, and
it's
was
kind of cool.
Multi-video plus the presentation all there. It was kind of, and all I had to do was tap a link. It was amazing.
It spoils you a little bit because then you go, why am I going to work? I should be flat on my back all the time.
All the time?
All the time. GoToMeeting.com. Use the offer code TWIT. I love this Gizmodo. This is a little bit of a Sophie's Choice question, a little philosophical question. Should your driverless car kill you to
or
save
not?
To save two other people?
Oh. This is like the Asimov's law of robots applied to cars.
This is popular science. A front tire blows. Your autonomous SUV swerves. But rather than veering left into the opposing lane of traffic, that would be dumb, the robotic vehicle steers right. Brakes engage. The system tries to correct itself, but there's too much momentum. Like a cornball stunt in a bad action movie, you are over the cliff in free fall. Your robot, the one you paid good money for, has chosen to kill you rather than potentially kill others in the other lane.
I want my robot to deploy the parachute out of the back.
Who did it? Did the robot itself? No. The programmer who wrote it? Perhaps. The executive who told the program this is the policy? Maybe it's in the law? As Patrick Lynn asked in Wired, when faced with a choice of hitting two cars or no cars, any robot's going to do the right thing, and it might kill you.
The robots are going to kill us all anyway. So
these self-driving cars right now, at least, are really just trying to avoid accidents
in
at
general,
all costs.
Right.
Whether or not it saves you or kills 20 other people, they're not making those sort of decisions yet. But certainly you can imagine a future where, you know, with vehicle-to-vehicle communications, each car will know how many occupants are in it, and they could communicate that information back and forth in theory. So if indeed there were an unavoidable accident, you could imagine, you know, a sort of negotiation and bartering going on between the two cars to debate which one should be the one that has the brunt of the impact.
Imagine this one.
Finally, a use for that baby on board sign.
Noah Goodall, research scientist at the Virginia Center for Transportation Innovation and Research, says, imagine your car, your autonomous vehicle, is facing an imminent crash. It can either hit a motorcyclist who is wearing a helmet or one who is not. It should hit the one with the helmet. Or should it make that decision?
Is it legal? Is it illegal to not wear a helmet? Maybe.
Depends on the states.
You probably would want to program the car to hit the person who is best likely to survive the collision.
It's hard to imagine that situation actually panning out in the real world.
Good for anybody.
So, yeah. I mean, as a person who rides a motorcycle, it's hard to imagine.
Do you write that algorithm in, or you just say, just try to avoid hitting anything, and if you hit something, well, there you go?
I mean, that's the thing. These systems are all very much being trained manually. It's not like, you know, there's a sort of neural network where they're just throwing them on the road and they're sort of figuring it out. Developers are going instance by instance and situation by situation saying, okay, you see this bicycle on the side of the road, therefore you need to move to the left, you know, 18 inches or 36 inches or whatever the state regulation is to give him that additional amount of room before you pass them. That's something that is explicitly hard-coded by an engineer at this point. So the engineer would have to go in and say, is this guy wearing a helmet? Yes, no. And you can imagine, you know, a million different permutations that would come into play before they would actually think to write that one thing. So I would say that we may someday get to a point where cars are actually making those sorts of decisions. I think we're a long, long way before we get there.
One thing Patrick Lynn proposes in his Wired magazine article is a random number generator to randomly pick.
I was going
to
say roll D&D dice. Yeah.
A 20-sided
2D10
dice.
2D10 and see what happens.
I mean, I think it's an interesting question. I don't know what the right answer is. We're actually going to talk about this tomorrow.
I can't wait for the science fiction short story that's about that topic.
It's very much
that
science fiction short
future
story, isn't it?
Moral premise.
You know? Starring a guy named McKinty.
Tomorrow on, I'm actually really excited, tomorrow on Triangulation, we're going to interview a guy named James Barrett, who wrote a book called Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era. And this is actually, we had a couple of interviews now on Triangulation, which is our interview show, about the idea that if we make smart machines, well, one guy said, hey, it's okay to make smart machines, just make sure they don't replicate. And that's what Barrett says, is inevitably they're going to start making themselves, and you're going to create not just artificial intelligence, but artificial superintelligence. Mm-hmm. And at that point, unless you explicitly program into each and every one of them respect for human life, they're just going to go, oh, screw those guys. We're just going to run right over them. So that'll be a fun interview. You did a thing on Volvo's self-driving car, Tim.
Yeah, I was in Sweden this week, actually. Volvo's got a new program called Drive Me, and they're one of the first to actually say when they're actually going to be selling self-driving cars, and it's 2017. They're going to have 100
really?
Self-driving cars on the roads in their hometown of Gothenburg, Sweden. So I went out there this week to get a little bit of a sneak preview of the technology, and you know, it's interesting for a couple of reasons. One, they're saying specifically 2017 is when we're going to be selling these cars.
Wow.
Whereas Google is saying, you know, we want to have some out there by 2017, but that's probably not realistic.
Are the laws in Sweden such that they can do this?
Yeah, they are. And they're working very closely with the government of Gothenburg, because right now it's limited to that town and limited to specific roads. Volvo's system is a little bit primitive compared to some of the other things that are out there. So they had to work with the local government to make sure that the lanes on the roads are painted correctly, for example, and they need to have a vehicle to infrastructure communication system so that the city can say there's a right lane closure at mile marker, whatever, on the highway, that kind of thing. So
this
those sorts of things need to be in place.
Fun assignment. I'm kind of jealous you got to go to
Gothenburg. pretty cool. The other cool thing about the Volvo system is that it's built on technology that they already have in their cars. You know, if you look at the Google car, it's got laser scanners on the roof and a bunch of other stuff too. The same thing with Ford and Audi and all the others. But Volvo's actually got laser scanners built in their cars today and some other simple stuff like that. So it's actually based on technology they've already got out there. They really just need to work on the artificial intelligent piece of the puzzle. That's what's missing right now. So the cost, in theory, should be very low to add this to Volvo cars. Whereas if you look at the systems that Mercedes and Audi and Nissan and everybody else are building on, they add a lot of sensors onto the cars that aren't there now. And those are, as of now anyway, quite expensive.
Wait a minute. Don't merge on the, you're merging on the freeway in this thing. Oh, wait a minute. He's got his hands on the wheel.
Yes. So the way it works now, you have to go to the roads that are designated. Okay. And you hit a button on the steering wheel. And then at that point, you'll see him there.
Well, I do that all the time. That's like my cruise control. I have cruise control on my car that will stop, you know, will slow down and will stop if some, you know. So I sometimes will let that, just for fun, it's a little nerve-wracking, let it do that. You know, it will slow down and stop. It doesn't do it very smoothly. I have to say, it's not as smoothly as I would do it. But so these guys don't have LiDAR like the Google cars do?
And the pedals.
They do, but it's only forward-looking. It's basically in a pod that's behind the mirror.
About 70 kilometers an hour.
This is where Ford got its Bliss system. Is from they briefly owned Volvo, and they got the Bliss system from Volvo.
Yeah, in fact, I spoke with some Volvo engineers, and they're having problems with people poaching Volvo engineers. They keep having people getting hired away. So I guess Tesla in particular has been hiring a lot of Volvo engineers to help them with their self-driving program. But yeah, Volvo's the only ones who are said that it's going to be 2017, it's going to be low cost. And the other thing is Volvo's the only one that said, we will take liability in any crash that occurs while the car is in self-driving mode, whereas everybody else is kind of shrugging their shoulders at this point about liability questions. Volvo said, you know, for us to actually make this a compelling option for people to want to buy, if we don't take liability, then that's kind of a cop-out. So therefore, they're going to say, if you have the car in self-driving mode and it crashes, it'll be Volvo's fault, and they'll pay any damages and take care of any insurance issues too. But it should mean insurance on these cars should be a lot lower.
I think car manufacturers will have to do that. If they don't do that, it's too risky. It's just not. So did you feel confident? I mean, you're driving on the highway.
Yeah, we were going 70 kilometers an hour. I definitely felt fine.
Oh, look, did you see that? The car was going to go in your lane.
Yeah, see, now that was a case where
he grabbed the wheel.
Look to the right or to the left lane, which is a limitation that they haven't programmed in there yet. You know, they've still got 3 years to figure a couple things out. Lane changes and things, emergency lane changes are not in the system yet. So that was a case where we actually needed to take over the car. That's one of the limitations right now. Hopefully they'll have that fixed by 2017. I think they will.
I mean, I feel fairly confident. I think this is one of the ways that this is kind of sneaking into our consciousness anyway, is that, I mean, the Ford cars park themselves. I feel fairly confident when I'm using the cruise control that keeps it appropriate distance between me and vehicles ahead and stuff. This is interesting. Now, you'll have to drive and only can do it in Gothenburg, Sweden.
Right now, they're working with a bunch of other cities. I spoke with their director who's working on government partnerships, and he said they really want to be in L.A. and they really want to be in Shanghai as well. So they're working with governments in those two, and they want to be spreading out pretty quickly. But yeah, like you mentioned, people think that we're going to one day wake up and suddenly our cars are going to be driving themselves. But it's very much more of an evolutionary thing where we've got adaptive cruise control now. Then we'll have this Volvo system where it can cruise itself on limited highways, and we'll have a system more like what Google is working on where you plug in the address and the car will take itself there regardless of if you're paying attention or not. So it's just going to be a natural evolution where our cars are just going to get smarter and smarter and smarter, and then they'll kill us all.
Unless you're wearing a helmet, then they'll kill the other guy. Makes me very nervous. Adobe's Creative Cloud. Now, we have talked before, and in fact, a couple of weeks ago, Brian Brushwood and I were talking on this show, saying that, you know, the idea that you had to, that was commonly heard that the cloud was unreliable, was kind of old-fashioned, that we just can accept it now that the cloud is there, we're all using it, it's safe, except that if you had been tied to Adobe's Creative Cloud for the last 24 hours, you might have been pretty sad it was down for almost a day.
Well, you know, 99% uptime means it's down for 3.5 days a year.
Really?
Right? 99%?
You're right.
So 99.9, still it's down for, you know, more than a third of a day.
18-hour outage affecting users throughout the U.S., Europe, and Asia. Now, that doesn't just mean you can't update your Photoshop. It also means, I think, that some of your photos and stuff might not be available as well because people are encouraged to use Adobe to store their data. I'm not sure if that includes that or not. Wouldn't be a big deal if you couldn't update or buy Photoshop for a day.
Right.
Might be a bigger deal if you're photographer doing an assignment and you can't get to your photos, I guess we shouldn't all trust the cloud.
And this keeps happening. I mean, how many times has Google services gone down and we can't get to Google Drive? Or Gmail itself going down is a huge issue. And I think that this is just going to be a bit of a fact of life going forward, a very ugly, ugly fact of life.
I mean, you want things to be robust in a situation whether either you're not on the internet or something goes down where, yeah, email not coming in makes sense because you need a connection to do that. But viewing your existing email or working on a document that's local or working on a photo in Photoshop, that's the stuff that...
SimCity.
Right. Sure. Exactly. You want some resilience for this stuff when it goes down. So it isn't just like, whoop, sorry, nothing. You can't do anything. Go take a walk. Although that might not be so bad to have to go outside and get a breath of fresh air. But right, like when I was using Chromebooks like a year ago, this was my experience too, is some stuff sort of didn't work if you weren't on the internet, which is frustrating, and that's because some cloud services haven't really prioritized getting it right offline. They only, you know, have prioritized assuming you've got a good, solid, and fast internet connection.
That explains this clip. George R. R. Martin, the creator of the Game of Thrones books.
This is the best. This is the best.
Do you have my audio?
They're massive tomes, and apparently you write them all on a computer. But unlike most authors, you're not worried about a computer virus. I mean, an author who writes a 1,000-page book, their greatest fear is a virus invades and destroys a chunk of their book. You don't worry about that. Why?
No, I have a secret weapon. I actually have two computers. I have the computer that I browse the internet with, and I get my email on, and I do my taxes on, and that computer. And then I have my writing computer, which is a DOS machine. Not connected to the internet.
A DOS machine.
A DOS machine. Is this remember
program?
DOS?
Yeah.
Yes, remember DOS? I use WordStar 4.0 as my word processing system.
Did you make this computer out of wood? Did you carve it? I'm curious why you decided to stick with this old program.
Well, I actually like it. I mean, it does everything I want a word processing program to do, and it doesn't do anything else. I don't want any help. You know, I hate some of these modern systems where you type a lowercase letter and it becomes a capital. I don't want a capital. If I'd wanted a capital, I would have typed a capital. I know how to work the ship key.
You yell at
computers.
You yell at computers a lot. What about spell check? I bet you hate spell check.
Oh, I hate spell check, yes.
Well, also, you can't write it.
Especially when you have the realm of Orbitor.
It's yes! Like, you can't. You would be constantly like, and then,
Daenerys,
you know, Lord Targaryen.
It's Hey,
Lord Targaryen. You mean tire center. No!
I love that. He uses DOS and WordStar 4. To write the Game of Thrones novels.
I totally get that. I do all my writing in a basic text editor that I've been using since my programming days. It's got no smarts at all, but it's got a lot of macros that I use. And, you know, I've been using this program for probably...
What do you use? Brief? ETF? What do you use?
Edit Plus, it's called. It's just a really basic Windows text editor.
I write most of my things in BB Edit, which I've been using since the early 90s. Yeah.
Real writers don't use word processors, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Fascinating.
WordStar, wow.
WordStar 4.
That's the one that's like you got to do like control
K-S.
W. KS, yes.
I still remember
it. Two keys to save something.
Yeah, to save it. It's control KS.
Wow.
That just shows you use it long enough. They're kind of, and this is probably why I just want to give it up. They're channeled into your brain and your fingers.
Well, I mean, I think that speaks to something too about how in the march forward, if you can afford to have a second, a writing computer, right?
Here
like George R. R. Martin,
so this is technically WordStar 3.0. This isn't 4.0.
All right.
But
I feel like I'm in the realm of Westeros.
This is, yes. You could see that he would feel like, you know, Neal Stephenson writes longhand with a fountain pen. Yeah. So this is a little bit more modern. Holy cow.
I think they had support for the tilde key in 4.0, something like that.
Name a file to edit.
Well, you know, this happens. We upgrade our systems
for
all sorts of reasons, yeah. And all of our other software has to come along for the ride, even if we don't want it to.
Right.
You know, you upgrade your OS, and now you've got to upgrade your word processor, and you don't like it as much, and it's sort of too bad. And George R. R. Martin, obviously, writing is so important to him that he's managed to have his computer that he fashioned out of wood, and that, like Conan said. And
love it.
Good for him.
Love it. If you want to read the Game of Thrones, I'm going to tell you how you can on Audible.com. How about that for a segue? Audible.com, our great audiobook. I know that you're an Audible fan, Jason Snell. Tim Stevens, living up there in the snow, you probably love audiobooks as well.
Especially for traveling, it's great to download a couple books. And especially for the international flights, if you want to close your eyes and get a little rest, it's great to listen to a book.
Yep. I love Audible.com. I just started a 43-hour book about the Beatles, and it's only the first volume. It's called Tune In, the first volume of the All These Years trilogy by Mark Lewisohn. And I have to say, you know, I've read every Beatles biography there is. I'm a fan. And this one is already, I've heard stuff I'd never heard before that was more authoritative. Really great stuff. What Audible does, basically, is that they are 150,000 titles. Pretty much every book that comes out on Audible as well. Same time as the hardcover as well, so you don't have to be left behind. All the big bestsellers. Audible's also been going back through the catalog and creating, for the first time in many cases, audiobooks of some of the great science fiction and classics. There's The Wind in the Willows, narrated by Shelley Frazier. That's great. That's fun. One of the great books ever. Actually, it's funny because this and Alice in Wonderland were John Lennon's favorite books as a kid. He read them over and over again. I know that now. Anne Hathaway reading The Wizard of Oz. Terry Pratchett's latest Discworld came out. Of course, Terry, suffering from Alzheimer's, is writing with great effort and yet has managed to write another novel. And everybody's telling me this is a really great story. I love the Discworld stories. And yes, The Song of Ice and Fire is also on Audible, although those books tend to be 2 credits because they're so long. Tell you what, let me give you 2 credits and you can figure out what you want to do. Visit audible.com/twit and the number 2. You'll be signing up for the Platinum account, which is the 2 books a month account. There's a new Sookie Stackhouse. I thought that was... These are the books that were originally the basis for True Blood. This is the problem. You go to Audible and you suddenly you find all these great stuff that you haven't... Oh, I want to read that. Audible.com/twit2. You'll get 2 books. You'll also get the Daily New York Times or Wall Street Journal Digest, which is a nice way in the car to catch up on what's going on in the world around us. From the new Freakonomics, from the Freakonomics guys, the new Think Like a Freak. Retrain Your Brain. I love Freakonomics. You ever read that? That is such a great book, yeah. That's probably the one I'd recommend if you're going to pick one of these. Just fascinating stuff.
Can I plug a book, Leo?
Yeah, what are you listening to?
Ancillary Justice.
You come up with the weirdest stuff.
By Anne Leckie. It's sci-fi. It just won the Nebula Award for Best Sci-Fi Novel of the Year. It's her first novel, and it is shocking how good it is for a first novel, especially. It is, it's kind of weird, widescreen, almost sort of space opera, but there are all sorts of questions of, like, identity and politics and gender, it's really great, and it's up for the Hugo, and if it wins that, it will have won every sci-fi novel award this year.
For a first novel?
Yeah. Yeah, it's great.
Wow. Ancillary Justice, Anne Leckie, that could be one of your 2 books, because that's 1 credit.
Only 14 hours long.
Yeah. Nothing. That's a trip to China and back. Let me just add that to my wish list. That's the beauty of it. You can, and every time I meet somebody who's an Audible listener,
This happens.
Yeah. Oh, I got to hear this. I've still got The Martian on my list. We were talking about that with Brian Brushwood a couple weeks ago. You've read it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm keeping up with the Audibles. Audible.com/twit2. You cancel any time in the first 30 days, you'll pay nothing. The books are yours to keep forever. But I don't think you're going to cancel. In the car, at the gym, doing the housework, I have Audible on all the time. Bluetooth speakers now in almost every room of the house so that I can play. I can listen to Audible when I'm taking a bath. I listen to Audible. I love it. Audible.com/twit2. Get 2 books today. Did you miss anything this week? You know, we were talking about that debate on This Week in Law. That is a show to watch. Here's some of the highlights from this week on Twit.
Previously on Twit. Tech news tonight.
We may all remember today as the day that the Federal Communications Commission changed the internet as we know it. The FCC voted in favor of a preliminary proposal to allow internet fast lanes with a 3-2 vote.
This Week in Law.
The FCC would have to completely change the presumption of regulation that was put in place not by the Bush administration, but by Bill Clinton's FCC.
As near as I can tell, your argument is this is too messy and the government sucks. The government has to act here because the nature of this utility is too important to leave alone, to leave unregulated. And the market, whether or not you agree with me, the market is not competitive.
This Week in Enterprise Tech.
NeoCity wants to remind the FCC why a fast lane for the internet is a bad, bad, bad idea. So they're throttling all of the FCC's IP addresses to modem speeds.
Twit, great tech news and analysis every day.
And of course, we'll be covering the FCC story big time. Also, a big story from Microsoft coming up this week. Let's see what Mike Elgin's planning for the week ahead.
Coming up in the week ahead, Microsoft's planning a Surface-related announcement for Tuesday, May 20th, at a special event in New York City. It's probably a new Surface Mini tablet. Plus, AT&T intends to launch its ultra-high-quality voice-over LTE with HD voice service this Friday, May 23rd. That's the good news. The bad news is that it's being rolled out in only four Midwestern states exclusively for owners of the Samsung Galaxy S4 Mini. The rest of us will have to wait.
What?
And Apple is expected to finalize a $3.2 billion deal to acquire Beats Electronics sometime this week.
No.
That's what's coming up in the week ahead. Back to you, Leo.
No, it's not going to happen.
I think those voice-over LTE, those five people who can get that feature are going to
have... On the Galaxy S4 Mini.
So I hope they know each other so they can call each other.
I don't know. Why even bother? Not the Galaxy S4. Big seller. The Mini.
No, that's a soft launch. That is a soft.
Very soft.
They obviously have a huge amount of confidence in this service because they're going to roll it out on such a wide scale.
Just going to have a couple of people try it just to see what happens. I'm not sure yet if we're going to do live coverage at the Microsoft event or not. I have to say at this point, another Surface is not exactly a earth-shattering announcement.
I'll be live blogging, so you can...
Well, yeah, you're going to go? It's in New York.
I'll be there. Yep.
Take taking the train down? Yeah.
I feel like they're making progress there.
Doing all good stuff.
It's getting... They're fixing some of the issues they had with it.
By the way, Samsung is not rebranding Heathrow Terminal 5 Terminal Samsung Galaxy S5.
It's just an ad campaign.
The Verge reported it as a story.
Mm-hmm.
And then Heathrow said, what? I don't think so. And Samsung's, well, it's just a little bit of a marketing ploy.
So paste in the chat room. There's a John Gruber, somebody who follows John Gruber, posted a picture of what the ads look like. And it's hilarious because of the way the text reads. It's Samsung, welcome to terminal, Samsung Galaxy S5, Samsung Galaxy S5. Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. That's branding.
Yeah, that's good. Terminal 5 is a hell on wheels.
It's a terrible place. I was just in Terminal 5 a week ago.
If you can avoid Heathrow in any respect, do, but especially Terminal 5. And I don't think renaming
it's a
it
long
anything.
Long metal tube.
Yeah.
That you have to walk through.
Let's see. IBM has discovered a new class of ultra tough, self healing, durable, recyclable plastics. And that's what Terminator is going to be made out of in the future.
Speaking of killer robots.
Yeah. 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 This will be fun.
Good God. We're putting together all the pieces of our own annihilation.
We're making it true.
Robopocalypse coming true.
Oh, man.
How about
another
this?
Another great book you can get on Audible, by the way.
The Robopocalypse. You like that?
Robopocalypse.
Robopocalypse, yeah.
You guys love your sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
The FDA has approved the first prosthetic arm wired to muscles. They received, the company was actually created by the guy who invented the Segway. And he got $40 million from DARPA to invent it, the DECA arm system. This is pretty amazing. It uses electronic signals from the wearer's muscle to induce up to 10 different movements in the prosthetic. That is truly amazing. Is that Dean? I think that's Dean Kamen demonstrating how to squish an egg with your robotic hand. So we are, in fact, putting all the pieces together bit by bit.
Mm-hmm.
I, for one, well, you know, welcome our new
welcome
robot
our
overlords.
New, exactly.
I think they're going to keep us around. Once they're smarter than us, I think they'll keep us around for entertainment value. Like that crazy old uncle who's you keep up in the attic. Okay, maybe not. Maybe they'll just kill us all. I like to dream that they'll keep us around.
I think they'll just make our lives so incredibly easy that we'll forget to make better robots, we'll forget to reproduce, and we'll just kind of die out naturally.
Right. So, yeah. There is a Twitter account that has only tweeted four times, created in 2009, a Dr. Frank Furter.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps you remember Rocky Horror Picture Show. In 2009, he tweeted, "So come up to the lab." Then he tweeted, "And see what's on the slab." And then he tweeted, "I see you shiver with Antissa." 5 years later, the fourth tweet. Patient. That's
timing.
Patience. It's all about timing.
Oh,
my God. Do you still have that screen capture of Twitter in 2008 when my friends, Leo Laporte, was the number one most followed person on the Twitter?
Don't we have the right to forget that?
This, I don't want you ever forget. I'm going to keep showing it. I'm re-adding it, to the Google index. Leo Laporte with 32,000 followers, number one. Close behind, he only had 106 followers to go, Kevin Rose. Then the president of the United States, Barack Obama. Then Jason Calacanis, Robert Scoble, Veronica Belmont, Alex Albrecht. There was a heavy tech TV impact here.
Merlin Mann,
CNN Breaking News, and Mike Arrington, the top 10 Twitter users.
Whatever happened to CNN Breaking News? What happened to them?
I don't know. Whatever happened to them? By the way, Veronica Belmont interviewed
Ann Leckie
on Sword and Laser. I did not see that episode, but that's a scoop. That's great. I'm sure she was fascinating. Must be young, right? Her first novel.
I don't think she is. I think maybe she's middle aged.
She's been saving up,
but that's great stuff.
That's the novel she had in the drawer.
Yeah,
well,
she's going to win all the awards. She's already won all the awards.
Microsoft is going to sell Xbox One without Kinect. And it's interesting, the reaction of the community in many respects was disappointment that Microsoft was going to have a $400 version of Xbox One. The thinking that they just couldn't compete against PlayStation, which had outsold Microsoft 4-1.
Are we defining community as the people who already bought it with it
for
$100 more?
Yeah. No, I'm glad I have it. And I guess part of the disappointment is that the platform was really exciting as, once again, Microsoft, instead of going all in, has gone back down and said, well, we want to sell more Xboxes. And it's true, they need to sell more Xbox Ones. But cutting $100 off, I don't know. Is that going to make the difference?
Well, maybe it's a psychological thing. I mean, I bought a used Xbox 360 a couple years ago, and I immediately spent $100 for the Kinect.
Well, exactly.
So it's like
They
get you in the door, and then you realize you really want the Kinect after all. I think the bigger story is they changed Xbox Live Gold. So it's no longer – it used to be you had to subscribe to Xbox Live in order to, like, stream movies on Netflix on the Xbox.
Sense.
Whereas with PlayStation, their subscription program is about getting free games and stuff.
Right.
And the new Xbox Live program is much more like the PlayStation Plus program, where you're getting some free games, and it's for online gaming, but
I agree.
Of your other media stuff, you don't need a subscription anymore.
I agree. I think that's
actually a ripoff.
Well, it was crazy, because you're already paying $8 a month for Netflix, and then you have to pay Microsoft $99 for a year Xbox Gold so that you can watch.
Just to turn on the internet for Netflix?
Nutty.
Yeah.
So it's about time.
That was a much better announcement, I think.
Yeah.
That happened the same time.
The same discounts that Sony's giving on the PlayStation Network, PlayStation Plus. You can get about 10% off of a lot of new games when they come out if you're a PlayStation Plus subscriber, which is a nice incentive too. I mean, usually it's a couple $5, something like that. But if you've got an Xbox One and a PlayStation 4, and if the game is $5 cheaper on the PlayStation 4, I think that's enough to sway a lot of people to go that way versus
the
other.
Right.
And the PlayStation 4 in general has been doing a lot better when it comes to, not a lot better, but better when it comes to graphics in this generation. I've been, in the last generation, I was definitely an Xbox 360 fan. I bought every game on there that I could. But in this generation, every game that's on both platforms, I've bought on the PlayStation 4 because the graphics are always slightly higher. It renders at a higher resolution.
You notice a difference, Tim,
sure.
Really?
I can't say as I do, but, if you...
Well, I don't either. And that's my question is, yes, on the numbers on the page are better, but it doesn't really look that much different.
I don't think it does, but I mean, it's like, you know, if you've got the car with 500 horsepower, the car with 525 horsepower, you probably won't notice a difference. But given the choice, you're probably going to go with the car with a little bit more horsepower. And that's pretty much what it's boiling down to. I mean, I think these consoles are very, very close, but ultimately the PlayStation 4 has been getting slightly better ports of all these games so far. And, you know, getting rid of Kinect in theory should be able to open up a little bit more horsepower on the Xbox One, and maybe that'll help. But Microsoft needs a lot of help in this generation, and I don't think $100 off is really going to help it. They've backtracked on so many things so far on the Xbox One. It just seems like the vision of that console wasn't quite right for whatever reason, and that's not really a good place to be.
I'm surprised anybody's buying either platform, because neither one is downward compatible with previous games. So if you want to play any of the current games, you play them on an Xbox 360. Mm-hmm. But I bought the one for the Kinect, for the fact that I can talk to the TV. I could say Xbox pause. It's a universal remote. It's infrared, controls all of the devices. So I could say Xbox watch PBS and it'll turn on the TV, turn on the AV receiver, turn on the TiVo. Everything comes to the right channel. It works really nicely. Thank you for the recommendation. I did get that
TiVo
Romeo, and I'm thrilled with it. It's a much better set-top box. And because we live in an area where Comcast allows us to use our cable card for Xfinity On Demand, we really don't lose anything.
Right.
Except those inane e-hostesses screaming at us while we're trying to find our on-demand shows. I don't miss that. I like the Kinect. As somebody's asking in the chat room, what game requires... There's a few stupid games. It's not about the games to me. It's about the... You know, when you sit down, it sees you and logs you in. It recognizes you. Somebody else comes in, it sees them, logs them in. You swap off the controller, it knows who's using which controller. I mean, there's a lot of things that Kinect did that I thought were very sophisticated. So,
and I think part of the disappointment is that those things may not get developed further now.
Exactly.
Because if indeed we see the vast majority of people buying the system without Kinect, and indeed the vast majority will buy the system without Kinect, then what kind of investment will the Microsoft developers make?
Right.
And of course, game developers are going to stop supporting it. Not that they've really been supporting it much to begin with, but really they'll have zero incentive to do so. And it'll be much like the last Kinect, where there were a lot of, you know, kind of party games and sports games and that kind of thing. But really not much else worth writing home about.
Yeah. Titanfall wasn't enough to sell Xbox One. That's the real truth. Hey, I want to wrap it up, but thank you so much, Jason Snell, for making your way up the road a bit
to see us.
We love having you in here. Tech Hive, and of course, The Incomparables on the 5x5 network. Anything else you're up to?
Well, go to theincomparable.com. That's my little podcast network of my own. We're doing a bunch of different shows. We got a D&D show. We got a TV show.
Wait a minute. So it's not a 5x5 show. It's your own network.
The main podcast is on 5x5, but we've got some spinoffs that are on The Incomparable.
You've got Bonus Track. You've got Not Playing
with Lex and Dan, where two guys who have not seen movies they really should have seen.
Talk about the movies
they watch it
seen?
For the first time.
Oh, they watch it.
Total Party Kill is our D&D podcast, and we're doing these TV flashcasts where we watch Game of Thrones this season, and we're going on right afterward and doing a little recap.
So I'll be watching that tonight.
And that's with Monty Ashley, who used to be the Television Without Pity recapper until they shut that site down. So he didn't have anything to do, so we did a podcast.
Good for you, theincomparable.com. I think this is a hot category is what is explaining what happened on Mad Men or Game of Thrones. These shows are so complex, they're so deep, and there's so much going on. And I think the writers that are writing these shows, people like Matthew Weiner, are putting so much into these shows that I miss. So I'll go back and I'll reread the recaps.
Well, that's it. The DVR thing has eliminated the ability to do water cooler conversations.
Right.
So instead, I think we turn to whether it's podcasts or websites that talk about
kind
the episode. So I know when I finish watching, you know, an episode of Orphan Black or Game of Thrones, I will look for Alan Sepinwall's recap on HitFix.
Because it's not just a synopsis. Yeah. It's an analysis.
It's like a review and analysis.
Yeah.
The synopsis is a little less exciting, but it really is like you're having that conversation. Did you notice this? What did you think about that? And that's what we're trying to do with the TV podcast is the same thing.
It was really fun watching people fall apart over True Detective because it had so much import and so much deep mystery, and it turned out it was meaningless. They just threw it all away at the end. It was like, what?
See, and I watched that without the backlash because I watched that about a month after it aired.
And
it was fine.
Show.
It didn't bother me because it didn't get overhyped.
But people were going on and on about
But we can't do that like the next day anymore because nobody's seen it yet. It's all on the DVR.
Spoilers.
So the internet.
I still haven't seen it yet, so thanks for spoiling everything.
Oh, really appreciate that. Hey, it's great to have you, Tim Stevens. Appreciate your time. I love what you're doing on CNET. That Volvo story was incredible. I hope you do more of that. I think this is a great beat for you and a great beat for all of us, because technology happening in automotive is about to just explode.
Yeah, I'll be doing something, I hope, similar for the BMW i8 in the not-too-distant future, as well as the BMW M3 and a couple of motorcycles I'm going to be testing in the coming month. So, there's lots of exciting auto content coming, and I'm also going to be at the Microsoft event on Tuesday, so look forward to that.
Great. Maybe we can get you to call in afterwards. I know you've been doing a lot of TNT. It would be great to find out more. Whoa, yeah. The i8 has swan wing doors.
Yeah, it's a pretty hot machine. I'm really eager to finally get a chance to try it.
It's a plug-in hybrid that looks like a Lotus or a Ferrari.
It's the closer you get to it, the more ridiculous it gets. It's got these kind of fins in the back that kind of channel the air around the rear
what
of the car.
The
it's got lots of LED lighting and carbon fiber everywhere. It's a very interesting car. High-performance plug-in hybrid is a bit of a rare bird these days, so I'm really curious to see how it drives.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I can't wait to see your review. Thank you for being here, both of you, and thank you for joining us, all of you at home. We do Twit 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 2200 UTC on Sundays at twit.tv. If you can watch live, we appreciate it. We get a lot of great feedback from the chat room. It's one of the best ways to do the show. When I don't have the chat room, I feel lonely and alone and sad.
Indeed.
So thank you for being here. We have one day left. Thank you, Dunks. See, already the chat room paying off. One day left on our Teespring T-shirt. We love these new T-shirts. Teespring.com/twit. And there are a number of, this is the black one, but there's a spaghetti strap for the ladies and a women's tee as well. There's some really nice looking varieties. And a lot of people have been wearing the white tank top around. And I particularly like that one for summertime. The Twit Spring Tee, just one day left to buy it if you go to teespring.com/twit. We like to do these one-month-only things, and each of them is almost a collectible. It's like a limited edition. So thank you, Dunks, for reminding me about that. Thanks to everybody in our studio today. If you want to join us in the audience, we welcome you. All you have to do is email tickets at twit.tv. We'll put out a chair for you. Make sure there's something lovely underneath each and every chair. See, watch, I love it because when I say that, they look. It's called the floor, and if it weren't there, you'd fall right through it.
Hang on, I got to check mine.
Works every time.
That's so mean.
Steve Jobs has taped a mouse underneath every chair.
Nothing under mine either.
It's a mouse from 2000. It's not good anymore. But
thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Another Twit.
He's in the can.
Yay. Bravo.